From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, allegations of a brutal crackdown in Zimbabwe, trying to restore electricity in Afghanistan, and the colourful candidates hoping to be mayor of London. Opposition leaders and human rights campaigners in Zimbabwe have accused the authorities there of sanctioning a policy of state-sponsored brutality. They say that in the confusion left by last month's disputed elections, police and government supporters have been beating and intimidating opponents of President Robert Mugabe. NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton talked to some of the alleged victims of the violence in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Well, there are three guys, actually.
This clinic in Harare has admitted for treatment several of the hundreds of opposition supporters its leaders and human rights campaigners say the government has targeted and beaten in a campaign of orchestrated violence and intimidation. Lying in his hospital bed with his two arms and left leg in plaster casts and hardly able to move, Denias Dombo described what happened to him. He's a local organizer for the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, which did well in the elections in his area. Dombo said supporters of President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party attacked him.
On Thursday, ZANU-PF youth came to my house at night, burnt my house. They beat me with sticks, iron bars, stones. They broke both my hands and my leg, my two ribs. So I tell my family to run away. I don't know where they are by now.
Dombo said even his cattle were destroyed. Dr. Nimache Mawere is helping to coordinate the medical treatment of people who've been beaten. He says at least 300 of them have come to Zimbabwe's capital with injuries from rifle butts, batons, bicycle chains, clubs, sticks, and an assortment of other weapons.
Yeah, the stories are pretty bad stories we get from these people. We have had clients from all over the country. They've been displaced. People have had their houses burnt. They've been beaten.
The opposition in Zimbabwe claims that at least 10 people have been killed, thousands displaced, and hundreds injured. Carolyn Norris from the New York-based advocacy group Human Rights Watch says the degree of violence being meted out and evidence of torture centres are proof alleged government supporters are targeting people like Denias Dombo for voting the wrong way in the elections. For the opposition leader, Morgan Changirai, and against President Mugabe and his governing ZANU-PF party.
What we've been identifying are camps set up by ZANU-PF militia and others very close to the ruling party to punish people for having voted for the opposition party. People are taken there at night, held for several hours, beaten with wooden planks and other wooden batons, and then just left on the side of the road.
Zimbabwe's agriculture minister, Rugare Gombo, says the opposition is exaggerating claims of violence because it wants the international community to intervene.
I don't know where this thing is really coming from. It's very, very peaceful in Harare. Yes, there may be clashes here and there. Honestly, things are quite peaceful. Things are quite normal.
The government has challenged anyone with evidence of state-sponsored violence to report it to the police so that the matter can be fully investigated. Lying in his hospital bed, Denias Dombo said that's what he did, but his attackers returned. Kerry Lynn Kay is the opposition MDC party's welfare secretary. She said Mugabe was resorting to a violent crackdown in a desperate bid to silence the opposition and stay in power.
Well, there's no point in complaining to government because as far as they're concerned, there's no violence and there's no atrocities and there's no burnings. People's patience is worn thin now. So people are getting angry, then there'll just be blood running in the streets, which is what we want to avoid. And Morgan Tsvangirai has always wanted a peaceful transition. So God help Zimbabwe.
At the clinic in Harare, Denias Dombo broke down as he relived his ordeal.
I am helpless and I don't know where my family are. So I'm desperate. I don't know how I am going to manage them. Because my leg, my hands, my ribs, all are broken.
Afabia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Harare.
Nearly 7 years after the fall of the Taliban, only 7% of Afghanistan has access to government-provided electricity. But that could change next year, at least for more than 1 million households in the southern part of the country. US and Afghan engineers there are trying to restore a half-century-old American-built dam and power plant in southern Helmand province, the heart of Taliban country. NPR's Soraya Sahadi-Nelson reports.
Afghan experts say that if it were up to Mother Nature, their country would be aglow with electricity. There is plenty of running water to power hydroelectric plants, like the spillway in the northern part of Helmand province. There's also wind to power turbines. Yet little of this natural energy is harnessed. That despite millions of dollars in aid earmarked for building the country's power supply. Even in the capital, Kabul, most residents only get a few hours of electricity every other day. Lawmaker Raz Mohammad Faiz, whose parliament committee deals with power issues, says it's frustrating.
Lots of promises have been made, yet nothing practical has been done to provide people with electricity.
But he and others acknowledge it's hard to build anything, let alone a power supply, while Afghanistan is mired in a guerrilla war. A $16 million project to rehabilitate the Kajaki Dam and power station is a case in point. Modeled loosely after the Tennessee Valley Authority, the 330-foot dam and power plant were showcases of American development in Afghanistan during the Cold War. They provided electrical power as well as irrigated tens of thousands of acres of farmland. But decades of war and neglect followed. By the time the U.S. Agency for International Development arrived at the compound 5 years ago, only one turbine could still be turned on, and it generated more vibration than electricity. John Shepard, one of the American engineers working on Kajaki, says they started repairing the power plant in December 2004.
We rehabilitated the first turbine and brought it back online in October 2005 at full capacity. And then due to the security situation, we weren't able to move forward with the other unit.
The security situation he's referring to is the Taliban insurgency. The group's fighters are plentiful in this part of Helmand. Major Mike Shervington is the new commander of British troops protecting the Kajaki compound.
I would say that it is an extremely important target for them because of what we are providing for the people of Helmand here.
He and others say the Taliban targets anyone who works on projects like Kajaki. The attacks continue despite an influx of Western and Afghan troops into the region over the past year. The top Afghan engineer at Kajaki is Rasul. Born and raised in a village near here, he says he's worked at the power plant for 30 years.
But I've had to move my family because of the constant gunfire. First, we moved to a village further away. That turned out to be unsafe as well, so I moved my wife and children to Kandahar.
Even now, insurgents operate checkpoints on the main road leading in and out of the dam area. That means everything and everyone has to be flown into this compound by helicopter. The engineer says it increases the cost and adds work, given heavy machinery has to be disassembled before it can be airlifted. If that isn't enough, workers here say they also have to watch out for old Russian mines that occasionally wash up along the riverbanks. The project is about 2 years behind schedule because of security issues, but Rasul and Shepard are confident they'll get it done. Inside the plant, first on the agenda is getting the second turbine working again by next spring. Some of its replacement parts lie in front of the lone working turbine. Nearby, a gaping hole descends some 60 feet. Shepard says that's the space for a brand new third turbine. That one is expected to be up and running later in 2009. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News at the Kajaki Dam in Afghanistan.
Coming up, the contest to be the next mayor of London.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Have you heard the one about the newt-loving socialist, the oversexed private schoolboy, and the gay policeman? Well, Londoners have, because those are the three main candidates in the forthcoming election for Mayor of London. NPR's Rob Gifford reports.
It's a tough choice for Londoners. In one corner, Ken Livingstone, Red Ken, incumbent mayor, supporter of Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez, who once compared a Jewish reporter to a concentration camp guard. In the other corner, Boris Johnson, journalist turned politician, known as Bonking Boris for his numerous affairs. He recently described African children as pickaninnies and claimed that voting Conservative would make your wife have bigger breasts and increase your chances of owning a BMW. There are a dozen other hopefuls, including a gay former police chief, but really it's a two-horse race. Tongue-in-cheek, heart-on-sleeve and frequently cap-in-hand, Ken and Boris are not your average political animals. But then the thinking goes London is not your average city. Red Ken is out on the stump shooting pool at a youth club in South London, his home turf.
The money's there.
Yes.
And
yeah.
We really want a double use provision over the next 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you've got plans to open every night,
this is
the time to put in for it.
The former champion of the loony left and scourge of Margaret Thatcher is discussing his plans to expand funding for youth centres like this. Youth worker Tony Sanders says he knows who he'll be voting for.
I think he's an excellent mayor. He will certainly get my vote. I don't think it's about class at all. I think it's about who has a heart for London.
Livingstone himself, who started in local government in the 1970s, says this is all about experience, dull and boring though that may sound.
I recreated city government 8 years ago, and we're just about to start a £39 billion transport capital investment programme, £4 billion housing programme, whereas Boris Johnson, of course, has the great experience of having run a small right-wing newspaper, where the only difficult decision was where to go for lunch.
Certainly, Boris does not have Ken's experience. Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson, to use his full name, is the kind of posh Englishman that many foreigners believe still lurks on the corner of every manicured lawn sipping a gin and tonic, but that everyone in Britain knows to be almost extinct. Educated at Eton and Oxford, blessed with a mop of unruly baby blonde hair, Boris boasts he's the only candidate to speak ancient Greek fluently. He's become something of a national institution, not least for his regular appearances on a popular BBC quiz show where he's recklessly honest about his past.
Have you snorted cocaine?
Yeah, I tried to, but
you've tried to snort cocaine?
Unsuccessfully a long time ago.
I sneezed.
In a country that has never really gone for the Hollywood crossover into politics, Boris Johnson is about as close as you get. He's had to tone down his assaults on political correctness, but so far he has seemed the livelier campaigner, not least in trying to scotch accusations that he's far too posh to be the mayor of such a diverse city.
I'm going to work like blazes for the people of London, and I don't think Londoners give a monkey's where you come from. What they want to know is whether you're interested in what they've got to say, you're interested in their problems, and that you've got some good ideas to solve them.
Out on the streets, ordinary Londoners such as Peter Revel and Max Grizzard are weighing up the question. Does the big personality with the big hair have the big policies for London?
Boris, yeah, he's a bit of a clown, isn't he, really, to be honest? Well, he doesn't have anything reasonable to say, does he? He just seems to make sound bites and jokes and comments. There's no sort of substance to any of his policies.
Well, I'm hoping he'll win, actually. Well, a lot of his ideas are fairly good, and I'm a bit fed up with Ken.
In the end, that may be what decides it. Are people tired of the incumbent and ready to turn to a new outsider known more for his personality than his politics? Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.